This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 22nd, the Norris Group proudly presented its 10th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joined Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event will benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event would not have been possible without the generous support of the following platinum partners: Housing Wire, Coach Fullerton, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Las Brisas Escrow, MVT Productions, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Realty 411, and White House Catering.
Doug Duncan is Fannie Mae's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist. He is responsible for providing all forecast and analysis on the economy, housing, and mortgage markets for Fannie Mae. Duncan also oversees corporate strategy and is responsible for strategic research regarding external factors and their potential impact on the company and the housing industry. He is Fannie Mae's source for information and analysis on the external business and economic environment, the implications of changes in the economic environment to the company strategy and execution, and forecasting for housing activity, demographics, overall economic activity, and mortgage market activity. Outside of that, you don't have a thing to do, huh? John Burns is the CEO and founder of John Burns Real Estate Consulting. He founded the company to help business executives make informed housing industry investment decisions, giving them the most accurate analysis possible, specific property and portfolio investment advice. John co-authored Big Shifts Ahead, a Demographic Clarity for Businesses, a book that makes demographic trends easy to understand, quantify, and anticipate. I'm just curious, how many in this audience have it? You got to get this book. It's hands down the silliest $29 investment. It's unbelievable that you put that in there for that buck. It really is. Thank you. Probably no surprise to any of you, I read it in one day with a yellow marker. David Kittle is the founding partner and president of the Mortgage Collaborative. David is a 40-year veteran of the mortgage lending business, in which he began as a loan officer before moving on to start his own company. He has also served and led the Mortgage Bankers Association, as well as several prominent MBA committees, including the MBA's Political Action Committee, Residential Board of Governors, and Board of Directors from 2004 through 2010. David has testified 14 times before Congress since 2008. We really welcome all of you back. Thank you. So you have to speak into that mic pretty well. I'm wearing one. You're not. I think what I'm going to do is I asked this question on the radio, Doug, but I need to hear one more time, to be honest with you. So, quantitative uneasing has begun in October. It's about to begin in October. So, can you explain how they reduced that balance sheet and its likely impact on mortgage rates?
We called it the Great Unwind.
Great Unwind.
So, at present, the Federal Reserve has about $4.5 trillion on their balance sheet, primarily of U.S. Treasury debt and mortgage-backed securities. About $1.8 trillion of that is mortgage-backed securities. This is the first time they've ever owned in modern times that they've owned anything other than Treasury debt.
Okay.
So what they're doing today is, when you pay your mortgage and eventually you pay it off, then that mortgage-backed security that's backed by that goes away. So that would shrink their portfolio, but today they're buying enough to keep it constant.
Okay.
What they've announced at their meeting this past week is that they are going to stop reinvesting that principal, so eventually the amount of money in mortgage-backed securities on their portfolio will shrink and go away. Now, they've not actually said if it will go to zero. It's going to get small, but there's a possibility they might keep some because they've used it as a tool and they might want that available. What does it mean for interest rates? Over the long term, we expect that the spreads between mortgage rates and treasury rates will get wider by about 25 basis points or a quarter of a point of interest or 40 basis points, something along those lines.
Okay. Just in the same line of thinking, Fannie Mae was kind of given the task of lowering their amount of loans that they held, I guess, that by 10% a year.
Portfolio.
That has occurred. Where do those loans go?
Well, someone else has to buy them.
Well, who was that?
The Fed.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So we don't know who's going to buy them after the Fed doesn't hold them.
Okay.
That's the uncertainty in the market.
Okay. Next one for John Burns. In 2008, in December, you wrote a 20-page report entitled Unlocking the Housing Market Recovery. And you talked about that we had gotten in debt too much and that there was already widespread wealth destruction, and we better do something. So my question to you is, now that we're 8 years or more removed from that, what's your thoughts on how that was handled? And have we set a precedent going forward that we would implement the same thing?
Well, he testified in front of Congress 14 times. I asked him if he ever listened, and he said no. So, that's why we wrote the paper. I wrote it in December 2008, right after Lehman Brothers blew up, and I ran all around with a friend of mine and talked to everybody I could in D.C., and I was blown away by just how people don't listen or look at numbers or set policy. It's just kind of crazy. One of the things that came out of that was the tremendous opportunity to buy single-family rental homes, though, actually. And I was trying to talk Fannie and HUD and others to stop dumping everything on the market because you're just going to make house prices fall on yourself. Instead, restructure something and keep everybody in the house. Be better for everybody. Oh, you know, we don't know how to manage properties. Capital doesn't want to do that. I said, capital doesn't want to do that? So I went out and got a bunch of capital to do it. None of those guys actually did it, the guys I got, but a new set of cast of characters came in, and I think some lessons were learned. And one positive thing I'll say about the government anyway is during the RTC debacle, they did write a white paper on lessons learned, and they learned the worst thing that could possibly happen was that the government could own banks. No, you joke. There were a lot of very big banks that should not have made it through this cycle, and the government learned their lesson that they were better off letting these guys run it and just bully them than taking it over. So I'm optimistic that there were a lot of lessons learned in this cycle that the government won't repeat again, particularly the regulatory groups.
Are you concerned about any unintended consequences about it? It just was handled very differently. In the 90s, we actually foreclosed on people that didn't make payments, and this time we said, don't worry about it, and we had people not pay payments for 4 or 5 years.
So that was one of the things I was going to talk about later. People are already asking me what's the next downturn going to be like.
Well, we'll cover that, but I want to know,
But I'm answering your question is, I think the world has changed, particularly if you go to Phoenix. 15 years ago, it was considered embarrassing to foreclose on, to stop making your mortgage payment, and it was considered a little bit of a damage on your reputation. Now it's considered the totally smart thing to do. So by the consumer.
Right.
So I think during the next downturn, the minute people have got no equity, all their friends are going to turn to them and say, why in the hell are you paying your mortgage? And people are not going to do it. Assuming the government's just going to, there's going to be no damage really done to you other than a blip on your credit you can clean up in 2 to 3 years.
So I was leading to this question. Has that cascaded into other debt, namely college debt? Are we now having a group of people go, why should we pay that? There's a phrase in business called a service once rendered is rendered worthless. They've got a degree, but they have debt.
Yeah, no, and I've got a couple employees that paid more than $1,000 a month in student debt, and you know, and I've talked to one of them in particular, you know, who went to a very good school. You got to remember, she was 18 when she signed up for all of this. It was a myriad of stuff she didn't understand, but you're going to a really good school, you're going to get a good degree, and you're going to be fine. You know, and still it's been more than 10 years since she's graduated and she's still struggling with this. And I think you need to put yourself in these people's shoes. This is the only debt out there you can't get away from. I mean, we really kind of structured something and took advantage of a bunch of minors almost, is a nice way of saying it. And I think some of them are now just saying, you know what, I'm throwing in the towel. And this is when we have a 4.5% unemployment rate, so they've all got jobs.
Right.
So the next thing coming is I'm thinking that we're going to see some big student
defaults. Defaults.
Okay. Delinquencies are about 30%.
Okay. We did a white paper on this a while ago, and we figured that the home sales volumes in the United States would be about 8% higher right now if we had not seen the run-up in student debt we saw in the last 15 years. That's how much it's holding back the market.
Okay. David, first of all, there's a rumor floating around.
That rumor is not true. I did not wear a thong on the beach in Turks and Caicos.
Oh, okay.
With cowboy boots.
That wasn't the rumor I was thinking about.
the other rumor.
Yeah. Do you have any comment on the other rumor? No.
Well, which one are you talking about?
Oh, geez, come on.
Well, it's an honor to be considered, right? And the rumor is out there, it's the worst kept secret in the mortgage industry, is, and it's put out there. I'm not putting it out there just to be, that I will be nominated for the next Ginnie Mae president.
Ginnie Mae president.
Right.
Okay.
And that Ted Tozer, right. So if that were to come true, you know, that would be a great honor to be considered. It's, from what I hear, a tough process, a lot of investigation personally and privately and all of those things. So you just never know.
Well, congratulations on the consideration. That's very cool.
I don't even know what you're talking about, but thank you.
Okay. Just in the event it happens, Ginnie Mae's role in the world of finance is what?
Well, it has a $1.8 trillion portfolio right now, which is actually the second largest behind Fannie Mae, larger than Freddie Mac. And that portfolio grew through actually the Obama presidency. This is me talking personally tonight, just answering the question. If anybody's listening anyplace, would, you know, so a lot of, are you recording that? a lot of the loans that, I survived the real estate crisis.
That's right? Correct.
All right, so the real estate crisis was about the subprime mortgages. I will still advocate today, as I did before Congress many times, that they weren't bad programs. They were just made to the wrong people.
Okay.
Right? There are still people who have subprime loans who are still paying on time, which would validate what I just said. However, over the last few years, under the past administration, many of the borrowers that had low credit scores went to FHA.
Right.
And those are in Ginnie Mae pools. And so...
And performing very well.
They're performing very well. They were underwritten under tighter guidelines. However, if there is any downturn in the economy at all, then that could be problematic. So, I mean, that is why that portfolio grew to be larger than Freddie Mac.
Okay.
Because FHA lending was, you know, up to 50% of the mortgage market over the past 8 years.
Doug, we're only going to have probably time for one more question each for this segment. I'm just looking at, you have a market sentiment report that comes out. Is it, it's monthly or quarterly? Monthly?
Monthly.
Okay. Year over year, what's been the trend of the sentiment of the people that you've talked to? More excited about buying or selling, or what's their mood?
Over the longer term, and we started the survey in 2010.
Okay.
It's been an increasing... sentiment tour, and just to be clear, the sentiment is about buying a house, so that it's not about refinancing, but it's, we were interested in what's people's attitude about buying a house. So it started slowly and then accelerated in 2012, and has been an uptrend until the last couple of years. It's sort of flattened out, still positive, but has slowed in the pace of increase. And what we're seeing today is the impact of the historically strong house price appreciation in inflation-adjusted terms over the last roughly 5 years. Annual house price appreciation nationally has been about four times the long-term average. So what's happening today is when we ask people, is it a good time to buy a house, that number is actually
falling. Yes.
And the primary driver is because of the high price of it. So when we ask people, is it a good time to sell a house, more of them are saying yes, and the primary reason is because of the price appreciation. So for the first time, those two lines have crossed.
One of the questions it asked is talks about the kind of the confidence that you're still going to have your job, mm-hmm. and that you might actually make aggressively more money.
Mm-hmm.
So the confidence level for the buyer is good for their personal situation, but they're wondering if the timing is not so hot. Is that
yeah, that's right.
Okay.
I mean, interest rates are still good, but the price appreciation is an issue.
Okay. John, you made a statement in your book, State Taxes and Growth Policies Determine Where America Lives. You remember that? I hope so. I'm glad. I never could tell.
It was co-authored. It could have been the other guy.
Well, hopefully you read the whole book, not just your half. Okay, so having said that, what's going to be going on the next decade or so as far as where people are going to migrate to?
Oh, that's a layup question. So 42% of America lives in the South, between Arizona through Florida up through the Carolinas, and 62% of the growth is going there. So that, you know, where can you buy a job? Where can you buy a house affordably? Where can I get a job? Where is the weather nice? Where are they actually recruiting companies to come?
Yes.
Is in all those states, although there's a few states in there, like the Mississippi's of the world, that don't get any of it. But that's clearly where the growth is going.
Well, we live in California, and a lot of our money is invested here. So, how's our policies rate? And
So we've got offices all over the country, and I'll tell you one of the more interesting shifts is we used to export people to Nevada and Arizona, and they'd stop there. They're all over the country now, and particularly in Texas. So the people are keeping on driving, and we do a lot of research in Texas, and there's communities that a third of the buyers are from California, particularly in Austin, and they can't believe how cheap a house is either. And the locals are talking about, I can't believe these Californians, they're driving prices up. No, seriously, because a $400,000 house in Austin is really expensive, but to somebody from California, it's 50% off, and that's how they look at it.
They love when Californians show up. I mean, everything's on sale.
Well,
so
now they're bemoaning the fact that some of our city planners are there, too. So they're getting zoning and other issues, too. So,
David, I wanted to ask you about the Mortgage Collaborative. It talks about being a part of the best and brightest minds in the mortgage business, helping small and mid-sized lenders compete more effectively. So who is considered a big lender? And then what do you guys do to help them compete against those?
Well, I think the big lenders would be the big banks. You're talking about a Wells or Citi,
okay.
You know, some of the larger ones. And we now have, as of this week, 116 lender member of our company. We have aggregate production in excess of $205 billion. The average origination volume of our members is somewhere around $1.5 billion a year. We have some that are higher than that, in the $8 or $9 billion, but basically it's about $1.5 billion.
Sorry.
And thank you, Mr. Putin.
We can always count on you. That's why I like that.
We're a threat. But it's... It puts about 62 vendor preferred partners together with 116 lender members together, and it levels the playing field. It's not a new concept. However, what we do is we listen to our lender members, and they ask us to do certain things that we're doing, and it's growing expeditiously because of we're listening to our members. So we have 38 depositories out of those 116 members, so it's diverse. A couple of credit unions, Boeing Credit Union, one of the largest, is a member of the Mortgage Collaborative. So it talks about our diversity and the fact that we started it 4.5 years ago, right at the right time. I wish I could take credit for it. I was one of the founding partners, but it was actually Gary Acosta, who is the founding, one of the co-founders of NAREP.
Yeah.
Is my partner in that, and Jim Park of ARIA, and John Robbins, a former MBA chairman. The four of us started it. Not my idea, but was very blessed to be asked to be part of it.
I'm going to ask each of you the same question, just a quick opinion. Looking at current policies, lending policy in place, which is the bigger goal at this point, making sure lending stays conservative or attempting to increase homeownership? You want to just pass?
Would you repeat that?
Sure, I'll repeat that. Looking at current lending policies that are in place, which is the bigger goal at this point, making sure lending stays conservative or attempting to increase homeownership?
Actually, I think it's easy. I think they're trying to increase homeownership, but they're going to fail.
And they're going to fail.
We've got more 90% plus LTV mortgages being made today than ever.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Sitting on his balance sheet. Soon to be your balance sheet. And others. There's a real misnomer that credit is tight. The documentation is extremely tight. And if you don't have the income, that's horrible. But, you know, Dodd-Frank said, thou shalt not make a loan above 43% debt-to-income ratio, and I think more than a third of the loans are above that. And I just told you what the LTVs are. And so those are the policies that are being implemented.
Well, those are the starting LTVs, but, I mean, as a pile of the loans, it's got to be the safest pile we've ever had, no? I mean, you just went up.
No, it's not.
Okay.
So one of the biggest misnomers about there, and we're on live, aren't we? Okay, there's one group in Washington, D.C. That is very prominent and does a lot of analysis back to 2000 and considers 2000 lending normal. And those of the guys who have been around for a long time know that in 2000 we had the loosest lending ever and the highest homeownership rate ever. Okay, it got really stupid after that. Everyone's comparing it to 2000 and saying we're tighter than 2000. Yeah, you're right. But there was something called the 92 GSE Act that really pushed home ownership for 8 years before it got stupid. And we're lending looser today in terms of risk, LTV risk, than we were in 2000, than ever, actually.
Yeah, let me add a little bit of color to that. One of the things that we've been talking about is that we are late cycle in this economy. It's now the third longest economic expansion we've ever had. So we're under charter pressure to increase access to credit. So one of the things that you want to ask is if supply is a problem and house price appreciation is accelerating at about 4 times the long-term average and you ease credit, aren't you being pro-cyclical to a downturn? So you have to be really careful when you think about asking for credit easing. Because maybe the basic structure and economics of the portfolio is sound, but at the margin, the people who you're going to let in at the end of this cycle, at the margin, would be the first people that would be off. So you have to be really thinking about that.
The Norris Group would like to thank the following gold partners. First Lending Solutions, Guaranteed Rate and Nathan Cheboya, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keller Williams Corona, Keystone CPA, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan, New Western, North San Diego Real Estate Investors, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Orange County Investment Club, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, Real Wealth Network, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, the San Jose Real Estate Investors Association, San Francisco Bay Real Estate Networking Summit, Sunoco, South Orange County Real Estate Club, Spinnaker Loans, Think Realty, U Direct IRA Services, West and South Coast Plaza, Wilson Investment Properties, Inc. See iSurvivedRealEstate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.